Yesterday for the retreat, we talked, we had a little bit of a talk. I gave a little bit of a talk during the meditation periods. And I wanted to talk about that same topic today and expand on it a little bit. So if you've already heard this, hopefully it will be slightly different. We talk a lot about what we do with our minds in meditation and don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the role our body plays in the practice of meditation and how we train our bodies. In the confession verse, we say, all wrong actions, behavior of karma, behavior and karma born of my body, speech, and mind. I now make full and open confession thereof. This points to the idea that there are three, we can think of ourselves as being, as having karma, habits, patterns, a physical presence in three aspects of our life, body, speech, and mind. And what we do with our bodies, our speech, and our minds, we get the consequences for, and how we train with them and deal with them, we get the consequences for. So a lot of what we talk about in terms of classes and whatnot is what we're doing with our minds. And in a very important way, what we do with our minds is the important thing. There is a famous meditation master in the Theravadan tradition, Ajahn Ajahn Chah's teacher.
Moon?
Yeah. Ajahn Moon. And he was once asked about whether he keeps all of the monastic precepts. In his tradition, there are 250 odd precepts, monastic precepts. And depending on who you are, they're pretty strict about keeping those precepts. And he is reported to have said in this inquiry about the importance of keeping those monastic precepts, I keep the most important precept. I keep the precept of guarding my mind. He was reported to have been an arhat and a very famous teacher in Thailand in the 50s, up until the 50s and 60s. I think he passed away in the 60s sometime. And Bodhidharma has responded to a similar kind of question about guarding the mind. So in a lot of ways, what we do with our minds is the most important thing. But we are body and mind, and what we do with our bodies influences our minds, and what we do with our minds influences our bodies. So I thought it would be useful to talk about how the body plays into our meditation practice. The reason this kind of came to mind was I was walking through the priory at some point, going from place to place, and just kind of, you know, doing my best to be still and watch what was going on in my mind. And I noticed something arising in my mind, and I thought to myself, kind of, oh God, I don't want to go down that road. And so I did what I normally do, which is to sort of drop my attention into my abdomen and focus on, sort of let go of that thing that was arising in my mind and focus on what was going on in my body. And it occurred to me, oh, isn't that an interesting kind of habit I've gotten into? Wouldn't that be an interesting thing to talk about and share with people? Because I find it to be quite a helpful practice. I'm not trying to kind of get rid of what's going on in my mind, but there's a way in which we, in terms of our daily kind of activity and presence, we spend a whole bunch of time spinning around in our minds, kind of pursuing ideas and thoughts in our minds. And it can be helpful to just simply come back to being aware of what our body is doing as a way of just dropping what's going on in our minds. Now, of course, again, what's going on in our minds can often be important, and we often will be doing mentally demanding work. And that's not a problem. That's not really an issue. And we can still be mindful and aware during the process of doing mentally demanding work. And still, this kind of idea of being grounded in the body can be quite, quite helpful, quite useful. So in terms of just the nuts and bolts of practice, there are a number of different ways in which we focus our minds away from, focus our attention away from what's going on in our minds, the spinning around and the airy quality of our minds, to what we're doing in the physical world, what we're doing physically at the present moment. You know, the practice of, say, making gesho and bowing when you come into a room is a way of changing our focus from what's going on mentally or what we've been doing before to a spiritual focus. Say when we come into the temple, we might bow when we come into the temple, or when we go into the meditation hall, the ceremony hall, we make gesho and bow. And that's a way of physically putting our attention into what we're doing, making gesho and bowing, the formal aspect of that, and letting go of what we have been kind of thinking about up to that point, and just beginning to concentrate on our religious practice. And there's a number of different things that we do in the temple that cultivate that letting go of and concentrating on just our religious practice. We make, you know, gesho to other people. We might, like during a retreat or more formal kind of setting, walk in clasped hands, or when we're in the meditation hall, walk in clasped hands. Or again, when we're in the meditation hall, just the bowing to, the formal aspect of bowing to our seat, bowing to the room when we sit down. All of these things are training our bodies to give expression to some particular thing. And while we're in the temple, we're doing those formal activities to focus our minds and focus our intention on giving expression to religious attitudes, religious principles, religious ideas. So when we bow to our cushion, we're expressing gratitude and respect. When we bow to the room, we're expressing our appreciation for training the Sangha, those kinds of things. In fact, the very kind of sitting, physical sitting posture of meditation is also expressive of a number of different things and can be help to support our meditation, but also can be expressive of what's going on in our meditation. So when you think of the classic image of a Buddha statue, they're always relaxed but upright. The face is usually quiet, peaceful, sometimes mildly happy, and still. And of course, their hands are in the meditation posture or some other posture. So as a sidelight, there's a term which we use called a mudra, Sanskrit term, that responds to, refers to a hand position or hand posture, or more broadly, a physical posture or physical position. And so the meditation posture that you see with a Buddha statue, the classic one, full lotus position, hands resting in the lap with the thumbs touching lightly in that kind of half moon kind of shape. And this is both symbolic of meditation, but it also, that posture over time has, it's been experimented with, and it is helpful to conducive to promoting the mind of meditation itself. That upright, bright posture with the hands in that position. In contrast to that, we might, you know, you kind of think of somebody kind of slouched over, head kind of tilted to one side, when you see something like that, it communicates an idea to you. The idea of, you know, maybe just fatigue or tiredness or, the weariness of life or something like that. And it's worthwhile noting that what we do with our bodies can be expressive of a wide variety of things. Just even not according to whether we're trying to approach a mudra or not, the ideal making, say, making gesho or sitting in meditation. But just when we're kind of walking through the through our daily life, our bodies, our physical presence can be expressive of something going on in our minds. You know, I'm sure you can conjure up the image of someone who's quite angry and what, how they're, and you see someone kind of walking down the street in a particular way, and, you know, kind of lean forward and tense or whatever, and you can kind of see anger in them. Or someone that you might deal with, you know, you can see them kind of come into the room and they're pissed. We're really good about being able to read that kind of language, you know, angry, you know, sexually provocative, despair, sadness, grief. All of these things we can see being given expression to. And, you know, that's fine. That's just what it means to be a human being. And in terms of training, again, that idea of training the body, training the mind, we're trying to cultivate, well, in that offertory today, it said, we want to make our lives as bright as the sun. And the brightness that they're talking about there is the brightness of being in harmony with Buddha nature, giving expression to the stillness, the kindness, the compassion of Buddha nature. And so in terms of maybe just, we can talk about in terms of being in the temple, what we're trying to do is let go of those other expressions that we do with our physical bodies and just give expression to the practice of meditation. Okay, so we try not to go around, even though we might be mad, we try not to go around expressing that in our bodies. Even though we might be sexually attracted to someone, we try not to do that in the temple. You know, we try to behave in a kind of modest and restrained way. Even though we might be in despair, we try not to give expression to that. Even though we might be quite fatigued, we still try to sit up, you know, somewhat straight, that sort of thing. So that we can be giving expression to that idea of letting go and the brightness of meditation. And then that can carry out into the rest of our life. And it's not, again, that I'm trying to say we should not give expression to any of these other things. Just by becoming more mindful of them, we become in control of whether they're expressed or not. Or we have some input in whether they're expressed or not. Or we have some ability to work with their expression or not. Because obviously they can become problematic if they're just let loose, as with most things. So the body then can be expressive of various aspects of mind. It can support aspects of mind. And it can be a tool of meditation, as I said earlier. In the sense of it can support our mindfulness or support ourselves, but it also can be, in a sense, there's a kind of refuge in the body, and you want to be careful about that. I'm not talking about a refuge in sensual stimulation or anything like that. I'm talking about the refuge of the groundedness of the body. The body, in a certain sense, is sort of like the earth element of our life, and we can be kind of grounded in the earthiness of the body. I tend to be quite enthusiastic about various kinds of work projects and whatnot. I'd probably, you know, if I actually had a body that worked, we're not a monk, I'd be the sort of person who was working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and paying complete unattention to my family and whatnot. I would just be kind of completely absorbed in work. And in a certain sense, by having a body that doesn't work, I am constantly confronted with the limitations of my physical body. I can't do the things that I would like to do. I have to be restrained in that respect. Because of just that kind of grounded quality in my body. Like today I'm sitting and put a fair bit of energy into our retreat yesterday, and I feel it today. I can feel the physical exertion of that. I'm glad that I did that physical exertion. I have no regret about that, but I feel today and I have to be careful not to overdo it again today, if you know what I mean. And part of knowing, and part of coming to know that, is the experience of having overdone it in the past and knowing what that leads to. I have this, I'm looking at my finger right now, and one day I was doing a work project with another monk at the Abbey. I think we poured maybe like 7 tons of concrete. On that day, no, it was more like 3 tons of concrete on that day, which I happened to mix in a hand mixer. Mm. Saying that, you know, concrete is really heavy and dense, so it's 3 tons of concrete is not all that much, but it's a lot. And specifically to do with a hand mixer, and you're moving it with a wheelbarrow and all this stuff. Well, that was fine, you know, I did that. I was really tired. And then I thought, oh, I've got a little bit of energy. I'll go back and I've got a woodworking project. I've got a little time and a little energy. I've got a woodworking project that I want to do. So, and it, it happens to be on the table saw, but that won't be a problem, except that I didn't really recognize how tired I was and I stuck my finger in the table saw blade. So there's a little graphic, and you know, it ended up being okay. I didn't remove too much of it, but there's a definite little kind of place here in my finger, which is evidence of that, you know, collision with the table saw. And it was quite painful, hit the bone, the whole thing, you know, emergency room exit. Oh, sorry. emergency room visit, the whole thing. But now it's there. I can remember that. Okay, this is what happens when I overextend myself. And part of it was just not being aware of the signs of what my body was telling me, not being grounded in the presence of my body. So these days, I really try to, when I'm feeling kind of lousy or slow or low or painful, try to really be still in that. And my overarching impulse would be to kind of forget about what's going on in my body if I'm feeling pain or ill or something like that, and just spend time in my mind, you know, kind of thinking about something else. But these days, what I really want to be able to do is really just be present in my physical self and feel the consequences of it. Sometimes you just have to, you know, just push yourself and go and all that, and I'm happy and willing to do that. And part of it is just learning how to be skillful with that is being aware and being present in it. Yes?
I was just noticing yesterday how I was in a little bit of physical pain, and it was coinciding or maybe even provoking a lot of emotional reactions as well. So the connection between physical discomfort and the mental discomfort is really, really close.
Yeah, it's really interesting how that is the case. And I don't want to say that it's artificial or something that we can kind of train away, but it is something to be observed and treated with compassion. And the more I'm able to just be still and present in that physical sense of physical pain, then the more compassion I can have with my emotional response to it, and in a sense patient with that. I think that I somehow have the feeling that there is just an kind of emotional response to physical pain that is kind of hardwired in, maybe, something like that. Like, you know, when you feel bad, you're kind of crabby or whatever. And at the same time, I've had to learn for myself, since I feel bad, felt bad a lot, I've had to learn that I can't, even though that's true, that I feel that's true, maybe I'm wrong, that there's a connection between those two things, I still get the consequences for acting crabby to people, even though I'm kind of doing it out of just feeling lousy and not being really angry. So I have to be careful with that. One of the things that I notice, like again this morning, I'm feeling the effects of the exertion from yesterday, and part of my response to being not feeling well and feeling tired and all that is to just want to go to bed, not do what I'm responsible for doing. And I've talked about this a little bit before in the past, and I think the thing for me in a sense, I want to just have everything kind of blur out and not have to be responsible for things. But what I've found is that there's a way in which that wish, that kind of wanting things to be kind of foggy or blurry, actually creates more, requires more energy in the long run. It creates problems and difficulties that require more energy. So when I notice that kind of complex of stuff coming up, I take time at that point to put a little bit more energy into being still. And that little bit more energy, although it does feel, in a sense, counterintuitive, like what I really ought to be doing is resting, but what I find to be helpful is to put just a little bit more energy into being still and just allowing myself to be as I am. That in itself, like now, even though when I was going down to meditate, I was feeling all tired and wishing I could go to bed, now, for whatever reason, I have the energy to sit here and gab at you all. Maybe it won't make any sense, but because of putting that energy in then, somehow something shifted, and now I have a bit of energy now. It's not magic or anything, I don't think, but often there seems to be something that happens like that, that there's some kind of transformation that happens in the meditation process. So, you know, you might feel pain or tired or ill or anything like that. And often the solution I find is to just put a little bit more energy into being still. Sometimes that gives you the clue, you really need to go and rest, or you're really sick and you need to actually stop and deal with this. So again, we can be a bit grounded in our bodies. We can use our bodies as a way of bringing ourselves back to the present. And the pain, in a way, is I find to be actually helpful for that. Oh, there's my body telling me that I need to be more present here, even though I'd really rather not. And just being willing to just be there in our minds, in our bodies, helps us to let go of what's going on. Now, there's another aspect of this which I was referring to a bit earlier in the talk, which is the idea of harmonizing body and mind. The idea of giving expression to Buddha nature in our physical as well as our mental kind of presence. And the term harmonizing body and mind means, well, I suppose it has many meanings, but I'm gonna point out the meaning that it means harmonizing our physical kind of being with the mind, with the Buddha mind, with the heart mind, with Buddha nature. So when I say harmonizing my body and with that Buddha nature, and the body I'm referring to there includes my mental faculties as well as my body, my physical body. And so partly what we're trying to do with that is in a preceptual sense, working on the precepts, but partly what we're doing is also releasing, in a sense, tension in the body. And, you know, with yoga, everybody has a kind of sense, I think many people have a sense of what, you know, yoga is up to, or at least the postures of yoga. You know, you often see in the popular media people doing yoga stuff and they're kind of twisting themselves up like a pretzel and doing all kinds of stretches and that sort of thing. In the West, we usually think of that as a kind of physical exercise, a way of strengthening the body, stretching the body, making it more limber. But in India, where it comes from, those postures actually have a spiritual significance. And that practice of yoga, the term yoga means union, and it means union with the ultimate, in a sense. So in a sense, our practice of Zazen is a yoga practice. It's giving expression to our union with Buddha nature. And in that sense, our sitting posture is a yoga posture, and in that sense, a mudra. But in any case, for in terms of the exercise practice of yoga, all those different stretches and moves are meant to open up help to learn how to release tension we hold in our bodies. We should kind of have in the back of our mind that there's a connection between what we do that's counter-perceptual and tension in our body, so there can be. So if we do something which is counter-perceptual, we may well find that there is a corollary tension created in the body. And depending on what our patterns of thought are, what our patterns of habits are, those tensions in our body can run fairly deeply. You know, you might have a deep pattern of lying, or a deep pattern of anger, or something like that. And those kind of deep patterns can result in tension in various parts of our body. And so, in terms of yoga, and just to be illustrative, what's trying to be done on a spiritual level is to help strengthen different aspects of our body, to release tension that have accumulated in various parts of our body as a result of these disharmonious activities. Part of the principle of that is the idea that there's energy that circulates through the body, the energy of qi or ki in Japanese and Chinese. I can't remember what it's called in Sanskrit. Maybe I never knew. Anyway.
Prana is energy, vital energy.
Prana.
Mm-hmm.
So prana, which is different than prajna. There's energy that flows through the body. I don't want to get too detailed into this, but long meridians and that sort of thing. And it's useful then to be aware that one of the things that doing meditation does is help us to expand, in a sense, the circulation of energy through our bodies. Someone once described the activity of her master Jiyu Kennett later on in her life as the excavation of all the dark places in her mind and heart with the water of the spirit. And so we often will talk about that qi, that energy, as being the water of the spirit, okay, and the circulation of the water of the spirit. We normally, in terms of the body, what we do in terms of this circulation of the water of the spirit is something that we're taught at the beginning of a meditation period, where we circulate the breath. On the inhalation, we imagine water light going up the spine. On the exhalation, water light coming down the spine and making a circle. Inhale up the spine, exhale down the spine. And you just do that corresponding to two or three breaths at the beginning of a meditation period. And Master Jiyu says, it gets the circulation of energy going in the right direction. And then you basically kind of forget about it and just allow yourself to breathe normally. I find this to be quite helpful, and in terms of my own practice, and it's something I find helpful and meaningful. But other people may not, and she has said, even a very experienced meditator may not actually notice this or feel it more than once or twice in a meditation period or over a long period of time. This is our primary way. Doing meditation is our primary way of harmonizing our bodies and minds, and is the primary way of dealing with tension in the body and releasing tension in the body. In terms of other kinds of practices, there's some acupressure and that sort of thing that we might do or know about. But the primary means of harmonizing body and mind in terms of this energy is by just doing zazen itself, by doing meditation itself, and allowing that energy to flow in that circular channel. When you make gesho, that actually is a mudra which moves energy in a particular way as well. And so that's also doing the same thing. It helps, if you notice it, a way that you can help your body and mind. You make gesho, and that, in a sense, brings the two halves of your mind together, the opposites together, and makes helps you to become more grounded. But the primary way that we deal with this energy business is just in meditation. So for myself, I set up that circulation of breath at the beginning of a meditation period and then forget about it. Unless I happen to get really disturbed or there's some kind of real distraction going on and I realize I'm way distracted, and then I bring myself back and recirculate the energy. Okay. And the same thing goes to be true in daily life. If there's something I'm really distracted or something quite disturbing going on, I might circulate my breath a couple of times, and then again just forget about it. It may correspond to a feeling in your body of moving energy. And one of the things River Master Jiu said, and I find to be quite helpful for myself, is to and this is also associated with the term turning the wheel of the law. And River Master Jiu said, you know, only the Buddha can turn the wheel of the law. And so I try not to produce, what I'm trying to say is I try not to produce any particular feeling with this kind of practice, or try not to produce any particular result or action, just kind of like telling myself I'm willing for the energy to flow in this particular way, and allow the Buddha to take care of the rest of it, allow Buddha nature to take care of the rest of it. And that just really kind of keeps things on a even, steady keel. I mean, there's a lot of energy manipulation kind of going on in the world with, you know, acupuncture, acupressure, and various kinds of things. And that's all fine. That's fine in a kind of physical level and with people who are kind of expert in it. But it's useful not to try to force energy to move in the body in any particular way, and just to be willing for that to happen. Because you can kind of mess your... talk to some people who quite seriously mess themselves up trying to force energy movement. So I think that's what I wanted to say today. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions?
I have a question. At certain times of life, it can be, things can just be more busy, or might have, like, I've been having a lot of deadlines lately, and so I haven't been, my body's in pretty rough shape. I'm in a little bit of pain from stress, and also I haven't been meditating as much as I was, or as much as I would have liked to, because I felt that I didn't have enough time. And I was just wondering, is it helpful to think about that as a consequence of a breakage of precepts, or is it more just consequence of the situation? I mean, there's definitely some consequences going on.
Yeah. I try not to, you know, I try not to think of it as, I try to be really careful about thinking about stuff like that as a breakage of the precepts. My approach to that part of it is to just look and see and be still in that, to the best of your ability, and see whether it is a consequence of a breakage of the precepts. It just seems to me that there are times in life when we are extra busy and, you know, can't be working in terms of, things don't work in terms of the ideals that we have about the way things are. You know, it was a funny deal, but I was a layperson for about 10 years, and I did pretty good about sitting pretty regularly and all that, under some kind of weird circumstances. But anyway, when I got to the monastery and became a postulant, there's a period of time at Shasta, or there was when River Master G was alive, where during the holidays, there's a kind of a break between training terms. And I swear I went, it was the longest period of time that I went without doing formal meditation that I'd engaged in since I started practicing. I literally didn't do formal meditation for like 3 weeks in the middle of winter. And it was really busy. It was just kind of going with celebrations and ceremonies and preparations and all kinds of stuff. And it was a very interesting kind of, you know, wake-up call that we have an idea about, an ideal really, about the way that formal practice needs to be. And it's not necessarily the case. And so, like, I found it to be really helpful because I then began to work on just being still throughout the day more and recognizing, you know, well, here it is, Reverend Master G is making the schedule, so it's not, must not be a breakage of the precepts there, or, you know, it's possible to be doing this without breaking the precepts. And then to be able to work on that. And at the same, and now, though, when you go to Shasta Abbey during that winter break, they actually do sit pretty regularly during those periods of break time, and find it to be helpful. Just from the experience of knowing that you go for an extended period of time without meditation, and it does have an effect. So for myself, what I tend to think of it is sometimes in life things are just quite busy, and I want to find a balance between being able to work on finding training in those busy circumstances, and also know that if I can, I will shift them around, or when I can, I'll shift them around so that I can get back to a more steady practice of meditation.
Part of it is you might not have even noticed the difference before you were training. So it's the grounding, it's the training you have done now that helps you to recognize when you may allow yourself to get so busy, you in a sense fall off your center in a sense. And also part of it, as Reverend Leon was saying, you can, you know, there were times at Shasta when we were building things, when we would go for months, and there would just sort of be no schedule. I mean, get up and run and go to bed and get up and run, mm-hmm. You know, kind of, and so you did have to let go of what your idea of what it should be, and you would find a way to train within the situation. You'd be careful about your expectations of what training would be, and so it is truly possible to train within whatever situation we find ourselves in. Even, you know, in a stressful situation, well, just look at the stressful situation. And another thing is, sometimes it can be helpful to see that perhaps in a stressful situation, what we're doing is we're fighting it. You know, we're saying, oh, I'm too tired, I'm too tired, I'm too tired, I'm too tired, or I don't have enough time, or whatever it is, or I don't want to be doing this, or it's unfair. I mean, whatever we do inside our minds, rather than just fully giving ourselves to it, making an offering of ourselves to it, okay, if this is good to do, I'm going to do it completely. And that has a remarkable effect on stress levels. And it helps the body relax and you find you can function. You know, there are times right now when I just don't sleep well for nights on end. And, you know, you get up and you just feel sick, and so, okay, you know, I can run away from my responsibilities or training or whatever, or I can say, okay, I'll just do the best I can within the situation. And when you say you'll just do that, that's kind of an offering that you're being generous in some way. And the remarkable thing is what you get back from it. Early I was talking earlier about his meditation this morning. Just, okay, well, I don't feel well, I'd like to go to bed, but I'm going to deliberately choose to go to service and to meditate. And it wasn't his intention necessarily to get a benefit, to feel better, but he did. And that's the strange thing about this. Is you give it away and you get it back. Not every time, not all the time, and you can't expect it. But within the, you know, whatever is coming up, if it really is good for you to do this, give yourself to it completely. Don't hold back.
And in a way, you don't even have to ask the question, is it really good for me to do this? You've already, in a sense, decided that you're going to, and so as an experiment, you can just sort of say, this is what I'm doing, so I'm going to do it wholeheartedly. And then at some point in the future, you'll be able to kind of get to a point where it'll quiet down, and you'll say, I wonder if that is really good or worth it, you know, re-examining it then. This summer, I'm traveling around a lot and just being in Shasta, and there was just a lot of work to do, and I just didn't do much formal meditation. Partly it was an experiment. I was spending a lot of time with Master Hario, and he just gets up and just goes. I'm rarely aware of him doing formal meditation or anything like that. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that he's deeply meditating, you know, in ways that I don't know about. I don't have any doubt at all about that. And I was trying to just be present. You know, part of my trip was actually spending with him, trying to just be there and be able to offer what I could to him, and just to see how that would work out. And, you know, nothing grandiose happened in the end, except that I lived through it and it was fine, and I was glad that I was able to do that. And then also know a little bit more about myself. Oh, I can live in that way or do that.
And that, the way you find out if you can do it is by doing it. The way you find out how it works is by doing it. And also, you know, right now you're discovering, okay, if I forego certain of the things that I have called training, mm-hmm. I may end up feeling like this. And so that's just more information. It's not necessarily, oh, this is bad.
Well, it's interesting, too, to try to make the things that are kind of taking up my time into training.
And the way we learn to do that is by doing it and by recognizing that, you know, by not doing something, whatever it may be, it seems to cause more suffering. You know, and the thing is, we need to be careful about what we're defining as the not doing. You know, it may not be that it's not that you're not doing formal meditation. It may be that you're wallowing in stress rather than, I mean, you know, you're letting yourself get caught. And I'm not saying this is happening at all. I don't know. But it's just, that's how we come to see what it is we're doing or not doing, is by watching, by seeing, and by letting ourselves go into these situations. And, you know, within the situations, we can often learn things about ourselves and come to see that some things are helpful that we didn't expect to be, mm-hmm. or that we can survive some things that we didn't realize we could, or that some things just aren't good to do for us for whatever reason.
A lot of it really just, in a way, when we're talking about training in this way, we might get the feeling that we're thinking about it in terms of like just a free-for-all, anything goes. And that's not exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about, within the context of having faith and being on the path, just cultivating trust in ourselves to learn what we can from circumstances, and to be willing to cultivate a deepening trust in ourselves, to learn and to be awakened adults, kind of like looking at this, okay, this is a circumstance which I feel it would be good for me to do this, and so I'm going to do that. It may be questionable, but I'm going to see what that is like. I'm going to learn something from that in terms of my understanding of what consequences are for me. And to really just trust yourself, trust your own good intention, that what you want to do is to train, mm-hmm. and to have it be, have what you're doing in your life part of that process. And that's a big factor in being at peace with finding training in these different complicated circumstances.
And when you decide that it's good to do something, do it wholeheartedly. Don't hold back. The master reiterated that over and over
again. Yeah, she would quote Martin Luther's thing, if you're going to sin, sin vigorously. And, you know, there's just a lot of good advice in that, because it's not that we're kind of sinning in that sense to kind of, maybe we are, I don't know, to get up to no good, but what we're doing is having that activity be done in the context of our training, in the context of having faith in the law of karma, having faith in precepts, having faith in meditation and the Buddha Buddha.
A full experience.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
At least give it to me.
Here we go.